Hey, good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It is about 9:20 a.m. and today is Thursday, March 26, 2020. This is Senator Von Imhoff. With me today is Senator Bishop, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Olson. And we'll have Senator Stedman. He's in and out doing other state business. Today we have one agenda item. It is Senate Bill 242. It is essentially a COVID-19 virus economic mitigation bill. We are going to start off with Julie Lucky and Carolyn Schultz to present the bill and present a sectional. We have several folks on the line to kind of discuss the various different parts of it. Julie's going to basically talk about intent language and various other aspects about the bill. So we are going to have Julie begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky. I'm staff to the committee in Senator Von Imhoff's office. So I would like to start off with just a few notes that, based on research and drafting timelines and the ever-changing federal landscape, it's been very difficult to get a bill in front of you that has everything that everybody wanted. So I will say that this is our first attempt to get the items that people had wanted to discuss on the table. I would ask the committee's indulgence that we know that some of the language is actually not quite right. We're working to perfect that. We wanted to get a document in front of all of the various stakeholders so that everybody could take a critical look. As I go through the sectional, I will note the sections that are being rewritten, and I would ask committee members if they believe that the language doesn't match the intent to please let us know. After the committee meeting, we'll be working on perfecting that language, but what I would hope the committee could give us today is an idea of where they want to go with the intent of this bill, and then we can work on making the language get that intent. So where I feel the bill does not meet the intent of what the committee had wanted, I will note that on the record. So the bill in front of us, to date we have had 10 health mandates from the governor making various public health decisions to basically reduce and prevent and slow the spread of the coronavirus disease. So these mandates have done things like close businesses, close schools, limited travel, and they will have a profound effect on our state's economy. While these are necessary to protect public health, we are concerned that the Senate is concerned about the impact on Alaskans, and that's why the Senate Finance Committee brought this bill forward. The disaster bill that the houses have looked at before focused on the effects of the pandemic, and this bill is basically meant to mitigate the economic impact created by these mandates. We want to do what is good for the community. Doing what's good for the community should not cause Alaskans to go hungry, lose their incomes, or ruin their careers or credit, and that's the very narrow focus of this particular piece of legislation. It's my understanding that there are a lot of ideas about economic stimulus that could be taken up after the crisis is over. This bill was narrow in focus and does not actually talk about the recovery and the economic recovery, which is something that, if that's a policy call to put into this bill, that's something that the committee, of course, will give us direction on. But the bill itself at this point does not have those economic recovery efforts in it, just the economic mitigation.
So on that note, Ms. Lucky, thank you for providing a little bit of background of why this bill is here in front of us. And we have also Carolyn Schultz here who can discuss the potentially the federal bills that are coming out. Just give us a high overview in a moment here. But this federal, what we're trying to do is there's an issue of duration. How long is this federal recovery going to last? How long is this economic downturn going to last? The state, we are meeting here today to try to find some immediate relief to the degree possible. We do know that federal funds are potentially imminent. We do not know when those will come. We are trying to provide efforts both in funding but also in intent language and, if necessary, statute change, temporary statute change to provide economic relief in all sorts of myriad of areas. So thank you.
So, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Finance Committee, one other note I would like to put on the record before we begin is it was our intent to not jeopardize or duplicate any federal funding. Therefore, there's not a lot of funding elements in this bill as we weren't sure of what the federal law would have in it. Those concepts will be forthcoming as we find out what is actually being put into the federal law. And as the chairman had noted, Ms. Schultz does have more details on what is in the federal law. But we are hoping to get some guidance from the committee today about what items should be put into the bill. So with that, Madam Chairman, I'll present the sectional, and hopefully the members have it. It's hot off the presses, so if you don't, my apologies for not getting it drafted until about 11 last night. Section 1 will state the findings and intent of the legislature. I won't go through all of those. This is just stating our intent, so if there's any edits to that, I'm sure the committee will let us know. Section 2, this was an idea that has been discussed in the other body about tolling deadlines for actions by the RCA. It was our concern that the RCA might be too narrow of a focus, so we asked the drafters to make this a little bit more broad to basically allow the statutory deadlines to be delayed and to make a statement that if hearings are missed, the statutory deadlines for hearings are missed, it does not indicate a decision, so it's not considered an approval or denial. We did not put in any good cause language in this section, so that is something the committee may want to consider, is if there's a delay because they don't have the ability to have telephonic meetings. This is what we were trying to get to, is if there is a problem with the health mandates or getting quorums or necessary things, we did not want the delay to cause a denial or approval.
What section are you on right now?
I'm sorry, section 2 of the bill.
Section 2, okay. Okay.
Okay. Section 3 of the bill states that payments including a permanent fund dividend or aid provided by the state or federal government because of this COVID-19 outbreak shall not be considered when determining eligibility for Medicaid or public assistance. This is often called a hold harmless. I just wanted to point out that sometimes a hold harmless is also used to talk about backfill money for, I believe it's missed federal payments. I don't know if Ms. Schultz wants to clarify if I get that incorrect. This section does not deal with any backfill of payments. This is just hold harmless language to say any additional money will not take somebody off of public assistance or Medicaid rolls. Section 4 of the bill is a forbearance on state loans during the novel disease outbreak. There are some drafting issues that are being taken care of with this section. Department of Revenue has indicated that there are some of their programs that might be considered state loans. The intent of this section was to ensure that if a person had a loan with the state, such as a student loan, or they had a loan for a fishing boat, or they had some sort of collateral, that would not be taken during this time. It is not the intent of the bill to interfere with any investment programs or anything else done by any other department. So we're waiting for some cleanup language from there, but the intent of this section was to make sure that people who have loans with the state are not going to be losing their good credit or their fishing boats or their permits or things that were put as collateral during this time.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, are we asking questions now or should we wait till the end?
What's the will of the committee? Did you want to ask questions now? Or do you want to go through the sectional? We can ask questions now if you wish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I hear that the loan issue has been taken care of for individuals, what about for businesses that have loans as well as municipalities that have loans out there, especially if you're dealing with petroleum products?
Senator Olson, through the chair, this section is broadly written, and I believe at this point would take into account all of those. So we are looking, again, I will tell you right now there are some technical problems. So what we were looking to do was to put this issue in front of the committee so that you could give us the parameters by which we would then perfect the language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
So on that note, just a moment, we also had, so the conundrum that we can discuss at the committee, Senator Olson, is to what degree does the Senate or the legislature versus the governor's executive act, Julie can tell me what that is. What are our powers? What is our jurisdiction? Can we tell, can we as the legislature direct a business or businesses to behave a certain way, i.e. banks to relieve loans for other businesses or to that degree versus can the governor do that? Does that make sense?
It does.
Those are some of the things that we're going to talk about, what our limits are as a legislature that we can do for business in terms of providing loan relief or requiring financial institutions to provide loan relief for a period of time. I saw that Senator Wilkowski followed by Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to wait till the end, but if we're asking questions now, could we go back to Section 2 and lines? I guess I just want to raise this issue because I want to understand the ramifications. The bill says, starting at 27, page 2, notwithstanding a contrary provision of state law and to the extent they're consistent with federal law, for the duration of the state emergency and for 30 days thereafter, statutory and regulatory deadlines for action or decision by a state agency are told. And I'm just curious if that would apply to things like school funding. Could the Department of Education say, we're not going to pay school funding for the duration of the emergency? I'm not saying they would. I'm just wondering what sort of authority we're granting the executive branch. Could the Department of Health and Social Services say, we're not going to make SNAP payments, we're not going to make food stamp payments, we're not going to make Section 8 payments, we're not going to make Medicaid payments? I just want to understand the parameters of what sort of authority we're granting.
And Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, the intent of this section is to state that if a quasi-judicial agency has to hear something and they have to make a decision, a yay or nay, and there's a statutory deadline that says if they do not have a hearing in a certain period of time, it is automatically a yay or a nay, that would then be delayed until they could get a quorum of members or whatever it is they need legally. As I said, this section was not written as tightly as we had intended, so any guidance that you could give us or the committee could give us on that would be appreciated, but the intent of that section was basically to say if for some reason you only have four commissioners and you need a quorum of three and two of them cannot be there because they are sick, it doesn't automatically deny somebody, but it also doesn't automatically approve somebody. And so that was the limited application of that section, or at least the intent of a limited application of that section.
And Senator Wilkowski, we have folks on the line that we can bring up maybe after the sectional, Department of Law, Ledge Legal, among others. If you just want to hold that thought, but if you have another question.
Different question. Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair, I'm not being critical at all. I just want to make sure we understand what the intent is and that we're crafting it as tightly as we can. And then just on the other issue, have you heard anything from the judicial branch? Because we're not including them in this. And I'm just curious, I've heard that the judiciary has not been having grand juries, for example. And I don't think they're having jury trials either. And I'm just curious if there is anything, if you've heard that from them, if they're looking for some sort of relief, there's a right to a speedy trial, and I'm just wondering if there's any sort of relief that we need to provide the judiciary or any sort of language we need to provide them or guidance.
Through the Chair, Senator Wilkowski, we have reached out to them and I have asked if they need any statutory authority. At this point, I have not heard back whether or not they need any. Their first response was that they didn't think they did. They are going to be checking and let us know, but I will make sure. I apologize. We did have a little bit of problem getting everybody lined up, but I did send a note to them. I just need to make sure that we can get somebody online so that they can answer that directly. But we did make an inquiry. My initial response from them was that they did not need anything, but we are obviously still getting information in.
Senator Wilson has a question.
Madam Chair, I can wait to the end of the sectional.
Wait to the end of the sectional. Ms. Lucky, please proceed.
Okay. And Madam Chairman, if I may point out, there is a distinct difference between Section 4, which deals with state agencies, which, of course, we as the legislature have control over, and the next section, Section 5, 6, and 7, which deal with, as the Chair had mentioned earlier, regulating things that are not state agencies. So on Section 5, and I will say that before we start On this section, there is a bill in the other body. Their staff has been working diligently with the Power Association and the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to come to perfect this language. So we do know that this language is flawed, and we are waiting to get some additional language from them, hopefully today. The intent of this section is to put a moratorium on disconnection of residential utility service during the state disaster.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that point, I think that that is an excellent plan, but the problem that I foresee is that those utilities, particularly in rural areas of the state, the small ones can't absorb the non-payments. So they are going to need cash to continue to run. Otherwise, they will not even be able to meet this, and everybody will be disconnected because those utilities can't operate. So I think that somehow we need to figure out how those utilities can continue to operate if the disconnects result in not enough revenue for those utilities to operate.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Hoffman, that is an issue that the other body has been looking at. They do have one suggested solution that allows the utility company, and I'm not a utility lawyer, so I hope I can summarize this in as well as possible. Basically, they would treat the unpaid bills as an asset, which would allow them to then put that cost over time. So that is one avenue available, but I do understand what you were saying is that they'll need operating cash in order to keep the lights on, and that is something that we will definitely look into.
And to follow up, Madam Chair, I think that the mechanism that you described may be a little bit more complicated for many small utilities, and I think we need to look at streamlining the process and maybe provide cash and accept the receivables as a result.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. In Section 6 and Section 7, you have provisions that say a person who is seeking protection to not make payments has to file something, a certification, and that you don't have a similar section in Section 5, and I'm wondering if you had thought about that.
Madam Chairman, Senator Wilkowski, as I go through, so just to put the sectional on the record, so Section 6 and Section 7, Section 6 would prohibit the eviction for non-payment of rent, and Section 7 prohibits foreclosure of property for somebody that has a mortgage. As I had mentioned before, this is language that is still being perfected on how somebody can attest that the language also isn't written clearly enough to say that it has to be financial hardship. There are some concerns about evictions for people who do illegal acts. There are some public assistance programs that require eviction if people do certain things that are illegal. So we are trying to rework those sections in order to accommodate all of those issues. And I will, I do not know if the affidavit, is it asking for an affidavit in this one? Or the statement under sworn penalty has been asked for in the utility service. I will definitely check on that. We did model language after a bill that had been drafted in the other body, so I will check on the drafting on that and find out.
Senator Wilson has a question.
Yeah, on that question from Senator Wilikowski, then are we going to define what financial hardship is so it's clear and understanding that it's related to X, Y, and Z, and not for just curious on that.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, that might be something we might have our legislative legal talk about. I'm not sure if that is already defined in statute or if you would prefer to have a definition for this. The intent is to put financial hardship due to the state disaster, and I wouldn't want to define a term that already has a meaning, so I'd defer to our legislative legal drafter, or we might need to get back to you on that. But we will provide some sort of definition, whether it refers to a definition in statute or we have to create something so people understand what that is.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be covered in other sections regarding people's loans, but the arguments that I made in Section 5 also apply to Section 6. If individuals have notes outstanding to make payments on those rental units, They want to try to keep their credit rating as high as possible. So by the non-payment of the rent, the landlords may not be able to make their payments on the mortgage. So somehow that whole process needs to be worked out in this section or in this section relating to loans for on a general basis.
Senator Hoffman, you actually bring up a really good point. I mean, with Equifax and the other credit agencies, all the way from businesses to individuals, I don't know if that's something that we can just put in intent language. I mean, if we're going to be looking at people not making certain payments on any number of items, that it, loans, car payments, any kind of revolving debt, that they should be held harmless for having a credit rating hit. I don't know if that's something that we can do on a, I made a note of it, and we can ask Ledge Legal to see whether that is a, if that's a national credit agency rating, that whether the state has any impact on that or not. So we have folks on the phone that are following this conversation, and we'll hopefully have them bring it up. Senator Wilikowski.
Just one other thing to consider on a section like Section 6, if the term of the lease expires, let's say in the next couple months, and the emergency expires sometime after that, maybe just something to consider. Does the tolling extend through the length of the lease, or does it extend if the lease expires? Can the landlord evict the person at the end of the lease?
These are tough things. Senator Wilikowski, you bring up a good point, because there's many reasons why a landlord may want to not renew a lease. It could be for non-payment, but it could also be for any number of things, and we want to be able to separate those two to the degree possible. I don't know if we may be able to separate those. I think having, though, the definition of the what's a financial hardship and having that a little bit more defined, I think could be the right idea or approach.
And Madam Chairman, Senator Wilikowski, if I may, this is one of the tough policy decisions, is if a lease is up and we're under a hunker down order, do you really want people moving apartments? And this is why the staff looks to the body to make those policy calls. It seems there's pros and cons. If you have somebody not paying rent, then the landlord still needs to pay their mortgage. How far up that chain do you go? Is it only natural persons? Does it involve companies? With the power, if you're not having people pay their bills, then you have companies that may be not getting enough income. So these are the tough decisions. If you have a lease come up and you don't want people moving, then do we force the landlord to keep a tenant in place? And where does the state draw that line? And I don't envy the policymakers those decisions, but these are all the issues that we wanted to put on the table when this bill came up.
Well, one of the other things that I also want to ask is, when we start talking about what is defined a financial hardship, we are looking at folks receiving unemployment benefits or potential continue to receive their wages if their businesses receive loans from the federal government. Can we control or direct how people spend their money? Meaning, if they're made whole or almost whole, should they be expected then to pay their rent, to pay for food, to pay for medication? If they're made almost whole, can we say you must pay in this hierarchy, your rent first, your loan second? I don't know if we can do that. So someone may say, I am not working, so I'm experiencing financial hardship, yet can we say, well, are you receiving any money in wage replacement at all? And if you are, then should they be expected to pay some of their utilities?
Hey, Madam Chairman, moving on to sections 8 through 13, and these are mostly having to do with the effective date section. So the way that the bill is constructed, because we are unsure how long the Senate Finance Committee and the legislature as a whole would like this relief to go, the bill is constructed so that we can define state emergency in section 8. And that would be then the definition that is used throughout the bill. So it's not necessarily tied to the disaster declaration, although it is in this definition. But if you wanted to change the definition to a different date, you could change it here. The intent was to have all of these provisions in place for 30 days after the lifting of all of the mandates, and that would give time for businesses to start back up and for people to get paychecks. So to the extent that any of the effective dates are contrary to that, the intent was to have it be effective, all of these programs be effective, and the prohibitions be effective until 30 days after the disaster declaration is lifted. So you will see that some of the dates may not conform to that, but that was the intent, and that's what we will make sure that we do once a date is chosen by the committee for the CS to go forward. We will make sure that all the various dates conform to that date. And that is the end of the sectional, but I would like to touch on just a few things, Madam Chairman, about things that maybe members were expecting to see in the bill but are not in the bill, and explain where those are in the process. One of the concepts that was often talked about, and what the chair just alluded to, was some wage replacement. Initially, we did want to put wage replacement in this legislation. It has come to our attention that the federal government is providing a certain amount of wage replacement, and talking to the departments, we realized that our efforts might be duplicative or even harmful to the process, because the federal law would, of course, take precedent. And I'm not sure if we have someone online. We don't have someone online, so I'm happy to field those questions if there are questions about that, or we can have somebody from the UI department get back to us. It is our understanding that the federal law as it is this provision at least is likely to pass, very likely to pass the way it is written. It provides, in addition to the UI payment that we give out for the state, an additional $600 per week payment to all people who are in the UI system and collecting the UI. In addition, there is a conforming payment for those who are in the quote gig economy that would be equal to that of the people in the UI. So it's my understanding that they would get that base payment plus the $600 a week. The department is working through, of course, the federal law will have to pass first, and then the department will be working through how to program that. It is my understanding it will take a few weeks to get that online. One of our outstanding questions is whether that $600 payment is retroactive, and so we will be providing the committee with that information. And it is my understanding these are all federal funds, but Caroline Schultz might have a better handle on what the federal government relief is.
Ms. Schultz?
I have one question.
Okay, excuse me, Senator Hoffman.
I have one question on the $600 for the people that are listening. Has it been determined, that that $600 is taxable or tax exempt, so that they know in the ballpark what they're dealing with?
Ms. Schultz, do you have an answer to that by chance?
For the record, this is Caroline Schultz, staff to Senator Von Imhoff from the Senate Finance Committee. I do not have an answer to whether that $600 per week additional in UI benefits is taxable or non-taxable, but I can certainly get back to the committee with that information. And to follow up on what Ms. Luckey was saying earlier, the federal government has indicated through this very large bill that will be passing shortly, most likely, that the federal government will be funding that $600 a week in additional payments, as well as the full cost of providing the base unemployment insurance weekly payment in addition to that $600 a week for the non-covered population, the gig economy, and folks who weren't previously eligible for unemployment insurance benefits.
Senator
Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it is critical to have that answered as soon as possible, because although we know the number, people are today planning out what they're going to be doing this week, next week. And I think we may not be coming back. So whatever we do in regards to this legislation, I think we need to look at least for 1 or 2 months past the time that we reconvene in January.
So on that point, Senator Hoffman, you're absolutely right. I think it's important for us to try to the degree possible, set a date that's far enough in the future. I think this is a gift that's going to keep on giving, and I'm not necessarily talking about the federal monies. I'm talking about the economic hardships. This is this could last quite some time. I don't know. We can have a discussion here about what the dates may look like in regards to, I guess, relying on the governor's proclamation that the health disaster is over, or another date certain. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. While we're on this topic, Ms. Lucky and Madam Chair, is this, I know the department's not on the line now. This is just a first sweep, but we'll get those retroactivity questions asked, the taxable asked, and I'd like to have an overview by the department just as an execution from 308 forward for the committee and those listening at home. And also, Ms. Lucky, you and I had been working hand in glove with the department. We're going to have some time on this. They say that they're good on federal receipt authority for staffing and programming. We'll just have them put that on the record. Thank you.
So, real quick, hold on, Senator Wilikowski. I just want to let people know if we're finished with the sectional, we can. You have one more piece.
I'm sorry, Madam Chairman. I have one more piece, and this was something that was requested to be drafted, but we ran into some problems. I'm not saying that it's drafter's fault. We ran into some problems figuring out how to explain what it was we needed and make sure that the system works. And I do know that we have someone on from Public Assistance that hopefully would be able to help us with this. One of the other things that we were asked to do was look at how we could get more money into food banks. That is something that came up during one of the hearings that the committee had. What we are trying to do is figure out how to provide food to underserved areas and to replenish those food banks that are having their shelves be emptied during this crisis. We, at the time that we need to get the bill done, did not have good language to do so. We are trying to work with the department to find out what we can do to help them make sure that the providers on the, you know, on the ground are able to provide those services. So that is something that is not in the bill. I know that is something that was important to a lot of people. I just wanted to let the committee know we are working on that, and it is a priority to figure out what we can put in here to make sure that that is not, that, that does not fall to the wayside. The last component that is not in the bill that we do have language being worked out right now is to allow AHFC to do a little bit more to prevent homelessness. And so there is some language that we're putting in there to allow them to expand their homelessness programs in as a result of a disaster. And so that should be forthcoming in the CS and just was not ready at print time. And that concludes the sectional.
We will have Senator Wilikowski followed by Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. On Section 10, is that something you guys plan on working on? It's a repealer language? Because all the sections say that this lasts for the duration of the state emergency and 30 days thereafter, and then it repeals all those sections on June 30th. And
Senator Wilkos, Madam Chair, I'm sorry if that was unclear. What I tried to say was that once we get an idea of where the committee wants to go with the effective dates, we will make sure that all of the effective dates conform to that. So I know that there are some inconsistencies at this point, but it seemed that without knowing what date the committee wanted, it was better to wait until we had that date, and we'll conform all those sections at that time.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't see anybody that can disseminate the work that I have done. Maybe my staff could pass it out to the members, if that's agreeable.
What is this work?
It's for the addressing the food issue.
Would you like to speak about it?
Yes, I will. There are three areas that I think you need, you know, and I'm glad that you mentioned a main point of this is food security. That is going to be an issue because people are not able to work to purchase food. So this question has been raised in my region, and I'm passing out a piece of paper that is being at least recognizing what quantities of food they feel need to be addressed in the region of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The second area is heating fuel. They're concerned about what happens if this virus locks people down through the winter next year, and a key component with people not being able to work will have heating bills that they may not be able to pay for. I know that I worked on a program that has addressed the heating fuel component, and I think that if you look on the is it on the second page or the first page, it talks about a program that we've had that that provides heat to those that are below the 150% federal guidelines. I believe that that may be still a good program. The question that I have is that more and more people are going to fall into this category, and we're not going to have, and it's an existing program, we might not have the adequate funds in the budget to address them. And the question of expanding the eligibility for the program to get fuel. So that is a question along with the heating requirements. And the third one, to those of us that live in roadless Alaska, in the far reaches, travel is essential for getting commodities out there, mail, food, and medical supplies. And I know that the travel by people in rural Alaska has drastically been reduced, as it has in the lower 48 nationally and worldwide. And I know that the federal program is addressing, prompting up the large carriers because of the financial hardships that they're having. I don't know if that program is going to include propping up the small carriers that service rural Alaska. So that is an important question that needs to be addressed, because travel for people that are in the remotest parts of Alaska is critical. Life and death situations arise, and I think that somehow those three items for rural Alaska, heating, food, and travel, need to be addressed, at least to the satisfaction of the virus and how it is affecting those remote villages in Alaska.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. You actually bring up three very, very important topics, and thank you for this research in your area, because it kind of gives us a framework by which to work on. One of the issues, we'll just start with food. It is our intent, as you can see in the bill, to address food security. There may be a dollar amount, not necessarily in this bill, but in another, the other appropriation bill, set aside to put money to a centralized grant-making department, if you will, in the Health and Social Services that will work, that will be directed to work with all the statewide food pantries, food service areas, soup kitchens, things of that nature. There will be varying needs in the different areas of the state based on how this disease breaks out, what their economy, baseline economies are, and so forth. So it is very important to address food, but to be able to be as prescriptive as this bill will say it needs 4,000 pounds of eggs, we're not going to go quite that granular. But I think that it is our intent to provide support for food. I'll pause there. Senator Hoffman had, and I see comments and hands up, yes.
And I would like to also bring to the attention to the committee an incident that happened yesterday in the YK Delta, and I would read it. This memo comes from the president and CEO of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, who has, 1,400 employees working for them and provides health care to a region the size of the state of Washington. But he said that it has begun. Raven has a policy in effect to deny boarding of anyone who has respiratory illness. Two babies were denied this morning. My chief doc called the state epidemiologist, and they tried to convince them that it is like RSV and not COVID. They refused. When COVID shows up, there are not going to be enough medevac aircraft in Western Alaska to handle our region. Ambulatory patients using commercial aircraft, not medevacs. If the government refuses to tell them to serve respiratory patients, then we need the Guard to mobilize in all hubs in Western Alaska to provide the the services to get these individuals to medical facilities.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman, for sharing that with the committee. I would like to hear from the other two committee members that had their hands up. We're more than welcome to jump around subjects. Senator Hoffman's brought forward food, fuel, and travel. Senator Bishop.
Was I first in the queue or third in the queue?
I
just wanted to say something on food security. We've been talking about it. It's a good point. We got to get it out there. But I just stress the point again. This state produced 55% of its food stuff 50 years ago, and today we do one. Here's a prime example why we as a state need to get back to producing our own and putting it up in the fall for emergencies. I'm fully supportive of getting the food out there. It's just a point.
I'll have Senator Wilson, and then followed by Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I know our office has been working, trying to find the sort of the food shortages and looking at what resources we currently have in the state. We know a lot of processors and freezers are still full. And in the past, the state has issued RFPs to these entities so we can keep their entity alive, but also trying to provide food out to the rest of the state of Alaska. And I think we're almost done. We're trying to find a package to help out some of the, right now, there's mostly just the salmon processors. Their freezers are still full. I'm looking at ways that we can have that intent language to add to this piece of legislation. And then also, if I may, Madam Chair, just have a question in consideration for Section 6 dealing with the non-payment for rent. Didn't know if it'd be feasible to add another clause in here for about availability to terminate leases or rentals for folks who may not be able to find work after this crisis is over, who may now be underwater. They had a good paying job for whatever reason. Now that job has been terminated, and be able to give their landlord a 30-day notice to be able to terminate that lease and rental unit if they are not able to find payment or rent, so they don't continue to be underwater for something they cannot afford to pay if they cannot find employment after the crisis is over.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Senator Wilikowski, do you have a question?
Just more of a statement, Madam Chair. And I know I think the governor had mentioned yesterday about banning air travel in the state, and I know that's, and I just want to lay it out for discussion after, particularly after Senator Hoffman's comment. I hope that's thought through very carefully if there is any sort of discussion on that, because maybe that might work in the lower 48 where you can hop in your car and drive to the hospital, but I think for many in Alaska that could be a death sentence if they're trapped in their villages and they can't get help. So I just hope that's something that's thought out very carefully. And I don't know if that's something we want to address in this bill or not, but I just wanted to get that out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Julie, did you want, or Ms. Lucky, did you want to comment on anything you've heard so far? And the only, what I just wanted to let members know is I would like to pivot to folks that are on the phone. We have Mr. Stuart Goring with the Department of Law, Shonda O'Brien with the Director of Public Assistance, Health and Social Services, Angela Rodell with the Permanent Fund, Cassandra Taggart with Real Property Management, Errol Champion, Alaska Association of Realtors, and Dan Wayne, Legislative Legal. So, Julie, if you just want to make a comment based on your research and what you've heard just now.
And Madam Chairman, I don't think I have, these are all the policy decisions that as your staff, we've been working with your staff, these are also the same issues we've identified. So I think these are exactly the things that we've been discussing as well. So we're hoping to get some guidance, and hopefully talking to the people who are online, you can get some guidance. I would just like to take just a minute to let committee members know we are in receipt of a lot of amendments. We appreciate your staff working with us to find holes that we did not find. Obviously, this is a very quick effort, and we appreciate the cooperation we've gotten from all of the staff on all sides of the aisle in both houses to make sure that we're not leaving things behind and leaving gaps. And to that extent, that people can just let us know, you know, keep letting us know if we need to be making changes, and if they have any suggested language for us, that would be very helpful. I'm not familiar with rural Alaska very much at all, or with, there's lots of areas that we're not familiar with, and we're appreciating and leaning on the expertise of the staff in those areas to help provide us with guidance on those.
So thank you, Ms. Lucky. On that particular point, I'm just gonna state the obvious. We are under a time frame. This bill cannot include everything that everybody wants because that takes time. So let's remember not to let great get in the way of the good. We have everybody at this table is working very long hours diligently to accommodate everybody's needs to the degree possible. Some of these answers may not be perfectly tied up in a bow by this weekend, but we have full faith that if we provide money, for example, or provide direction to the various different departments, that they will execute the intent to the best of their ability, because I believe we all are Alaskans. We all want to make sure that nobody suffers and that everyone gets access to health care and access to the basic health, safety, and transportation. So on that note, we have folks online. Going back to some of the questions that I recall earlier, we talked about what is defined as a financial hardship. If people are receiving wage replacement, should they be required to pay rent and utilities, things of this nature? I'm not really sure. We're going to do a brief at ease, okay? Thank you. We are back on the record. What we are going to do is listen to committee staff Carolyn Schultz to give an overview of the federal stimulus package, and then we're going to have Julie describe two of the topics that we want to hear about, food security and loan relief, by two of the folks on the phone. So Ms. Schultz, if you could begin with the federal overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, this is Caroline Schultz, staff to the committee. I want to first touch on some of the items that are in the currently being worked federal legislation relating to the COVID economic response that were specific to some of the comments made at the table. And I just want to let the committee and the public know that I'm just scratching the surface. This is an 800, 900 page bill coming out of the Senate, and we don't yet know all of the provisions, and we don't understand their impacts fully at this point. And we do not know exactly how much funding the state of Alaska is going to receive from all of these appropriations. Many of them, similar to our effort here, are utilizing existing federal granting programs or federal formula programs. So we can imagine, it's safe to assume for many of these, that Alaska will get its relative formula share of a lot of these. So I'm just going to touch on a few of them for the committee's information. So if there are concerns that there are gaps in the legislation that we're working on, some of those gaps may be filled in by some of these federal elements. There is a $5 billion appropriation to the Community Block Grant Development Program, and that's an important federal source of funding for many of our community nonprofits. So especially food banks, emergency areas, that's something that I think will continue to provide federal subsidy to our food banks. There will be subsidies for state disaster relief response, which also can involve food as well as transportation. That's something that Senator Hoffman and Senator Wilikowski discussed. There's another important thing relating to transportation is that the extension for Real ID has been moved to September 30th, 2021. I know that that's been a topic that has been discussed at our table, and I just think that it's important to note that that extension will be impacted. There's funding available, of course, for hospitals, behavioral health clinics, directly to subsidize those providers of health care, especially in rural areas. There's a focus in this legislation on making sure rural hospitals stay solvent. There is funding for child care grants to make sure that child care providers will be able to remain in business throughout this time. There's funding for the Community Services Block Grant Program, which also provides funding to nonprofits and other community resources. Senator Hoffman touched on heating. There is funding in this bill, additional funding for the LIHEAP program, the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program. That's a state federal cooperative program managed by the Division of Public Assistance, and Director O'Brien could touch on that. On the transportation front, there is a considerable amount of funding available for the National Guard for response, for deployment, response, and transportation. So, in the case that it does come to the National Guard getting involved, there will be federal funding available for that. There's urban and rural transportation block grant funding available, also that I imagine will be used for the smaller transportation issues. I know there's, of course, been discussion on the larger airline funding available, but there's also been focus in the bill on making sure that there's funding for the rural and urban transit systems on the ground. And those are some of the smaller issues that relate to the things we've talked about. Of course, on the large scale, there's the unemployment insurance, the extra $600 weekly dollars, and the extension of unemployment insurance to non-covered individuals. There's a $1,200 payment to individuals or a $2,400 payment to married couples that starts to adjust downward at the higher income levels. There is also it seems like there's going to be a very large tranche of funding made available to states. It says the minimum amount available for a state is $1.25 billion. Because of Alaska's small population, I think it is safe to guess that we will be on that low end, but a $1.25 billion payment to the state of Alaska isn't anything to sneeze at. So,
on that note, Caroline, $1.25 billion, is that going to be spread out on all these programs that you just said, or is it going to go to the general fund?
Madam Chairman, that funding is specific to be directed to states and local governments. The local government provision in the bill is that it will go to local governments with a population of 500,000 or more. Alaska doesn't have any with 500,000 or more, so that means that the full amount will go to the state. There's some direct funding for the state of Alaska for education as well. There's going to be direct funding actually to the Office of the Governor that focuses on education. There's also $8 billion in the federal legislation available for tribal governments, and Alaska has, nearly half of all tribal government entities are in our state. So that will be another infusion of funds.
So thank you for that. Do you know or can you find out where the $1.25 billion coming to the state of Alaska, where that money will go? Is it one large check? Where is it? Payments for the next 4 months, a little bit each month, $250 million each month? Where is it? Just to the disaster relief fund? Is it to the general fund? Who directs that, how that money is spent?
Madam Chair, I'm working constantly to get information as it unfolds through this, and I will get back to the committee as soon as we have those details available.
Thank you. Do you have any more on the list?
If there are any specific questions or areas that I didn't touch on, of course there is a lot more included. I tried to touch on the highlights and the areas that we have brought up today in our discussions. But unless there are further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you. So Ms. Lucky, you brought up two questions pertaining to folks here on the phone that the committee would be interested in hearing.
Madam Chairman, for the record, Julie Lucky, staff to Senator Von Imhoff. We do have both our drafter online and a Department of Law attorney. I know the committee had some questions about how far can someone step in between a borrower and a bank. There might be some other legal questions about how far we can go with some of these provisions, and so that might be where the, since we have those assets online, we might want to be asking those questions at this time. We also have somebody from public assistance who we were hoping could discuss how to deal with the food security, get it out to the areas that are underserved and that are in most need, and also if there were questions about hold harmless provisions or eligibility for public assistance or Medicaid programs. Those are the two assets that I think we have online now, if the committee would like to direct questions to those topics.
Thank you, Ms. Lucky. We do have the Department of Law on the top of the list. So the question is how far can the state step in between a borrower and a bank, and can the state require a bank to do certain behaviors such as not repossess vehicles, not start foreclosure proceedings on a person who's not making mortgage payments. So the question is what jurisdiction does the state legislature have? So we have Mr. Stuart Goring with the Department of Law. Mr. Goring, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you. For the record, Stuart Goring, Assistant Attorney General, and I am going to have to refer that question to one of my colleagues, and I am currently inquiring about to whom that question should be directed. I was calling in primarily to deal with questions related to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and issues related to utility disconnects and that sort of thing. So unfortunately, the question you're asking is a very good one, but it's outside my expertise, and I would hate to mislead you by shooting from the hip.
So are you going to work then on your end to find, like you mentioned, a colleague that does have expertise in this area, and can that colleague call up the line here?
That I've actually initiated that already. I've put in a request to the section chief of our legislation section, and I actually expected she was probably monitoring this hearing, so she may be scrambling around trying to find someone who can answer your questions at this point, but that's in process. I'm not sure exactly how we would do it, but I can let you know when we have someone available. I'm guessing that will be someone who will be calling in on your conference line and identifying themselves to answer that question.
Yes, I will see them when they come up. So what we can do is table that for now and move to the next one, but I do see Senator Wilson's hand up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The question that he may be able to answer is, what about our contractual obligations at this time? Can the state of Alaska push back some of those financial contractual obligations to make other more immediate payments available, and what things can happen during that time? And then also just to know if we have something in the plans and works for sort of like school districts, employees and contracts, you know, for the bus drivers, sanitation, cafeteria folks that may be on contractual obligations. Is there things that we can do as a state to also put more of a moratorium on those payments or items, or for other, maybe more other state government or, I mean, local government type officials as well, to help them out in terms of their contractual obligations?
Well, just to build on that, I think that there is an endless examples of contractual obligations and payments between entities. How do we handle that? E-commerce has ceased in ways that are unfathomable. How far do we hold every trade held harmless? Mr. Goring, maybe I do recall that Senator Wilikowski brought up Section 2, page 2, line 30. Action or decision by a state agency are told, and a failure by a state agency to act on filing does not constitute approval or denial of the state agency. And I think the example that you gave was, when this is over, can a particular state department just simply refuse to pay its obligations, a school district, a health health department? Did I get that right, Senator Wilikowski?
Madam Chair, just the way the language was written, I don't know that was the intent, but that's the way I think you could read it.
And we do have Ledge Legal here, but since Mr. Goring, you are on the line, do you have a comment on that particular line?
Yes, through the chair of Senator Wielichowski. The way that that language is written applies to statutory and regulatory actions for action or decision. So typically those would be things like applications. In the case of the Regulatory Commission, those would be tariff filings. In addition to applications, they could be dispute resolution in a quasi-judicial setting or something like that. And so many of those have, and certainly as far as the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is concerned, there are consequences for missing those timelines, which in some cases include either automatic denial or automatic approval. It's my understanding that the intent of this bill, and I believe the language is relatively clear, that the intention is expressed in the bill, that this would apply to those kinds of decisions, not I guess what I would describe as executive kinds of decisions in terms of what checks to write or what contracts to enter into or something like that. So it might apply to issuing a grant or something like that, but I think this is directed primarily at what would be described as quasi-judicial kinds of decisions as opposed to all state decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. The other agency that we have online was Shonda O'Brien with Director of Public Assistance. There was questions about food security and hold harmless provisions. Ms. O'Brien, you're on the line. Can you hear us?
Hi, this is Shonda O'Brien, Director of Public Assistance.
You've been following along the conversation. Would you care to provide us more clarity and direction on the food security and the hold harmless provisions?
Sure. So for the record, Shonda O'Brien, Director for the Division of Public Assistance. So we're working on a number of different efforts right now, and I believe some information is being shared with everyone about some of the work that's already underway in the division to allow for relaxing of our rules around food stamps and other programs to maintain eligibility for individuals that are on the program, and then also to make it easier for folks to apply and become eligible who may not already be participating in our programs. And so that information is being shared. In terms of the hold harmless provisions, at the state level, for anything that would be issued under the permanent fund dividend program, we have the PFD hold harmless provisions already in place, and authority there to continue with using those funds to offset any potential loss of benefits as a result of additional funds being issued to folks. At the federal level, we are still waiting for guidance from our federal partners on what the rules will be and how we will apply them to any other funds that may be issued. One thing, though, that we are experiencing with our federal partners is that there's definitely an intent to relax rules around eligibility and to maintain services for individuals, and then to increase the ability for other folks to be able to apply for benefits. So they've been working really closely with us on getting that guidance out as it becomes available. So I would imagine the intent would be the same for any funds that would be issued at the federal level as well. We just don't have any formal guidance yet on that. So as it becomes available, we'll continue to update folks on what efforts we're taking and what we're doing. And then also there was some communication from Senator Olson regarding heating assistance and things of that nature. And we did just learn yesterday that additional funds are being made available to states for the federal LIHEAP program, which we would be working to incorporate into our system as well.
Thank you very much, Shonda. And we understand that this is somewhat of a work in progress. I do know that our office received a call from Department of Health and Social Services, Sana Eford. This committee should be familiar with her, Administrative Services Director for the department. They do oversee grants to food banks, so it does make sense to if we wanted to provide a grant to DHSS, and they could disseminate and provide the money to the food banks all across Alaska where appropriate. And that's where the Bethel Food Bank, the Anchorage Food Bank, the Fairbanks Food Bank would work with the Alaska Food Bank to provide assistance that way. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Sorry, just drew a blank. Ms. Schultz had mentioned it. I just wanted to go one step a little bit deeper on this food and agriculture section of the stimulus plan. It definitely spells out, it doesn't have an amount, but it definitely spells out money for food banks, farmers markets, et cetera. And so, thank you.
So the issue with this particular effort is that we have state and federal layered. How do we work together? How do we not duplicate it? How do we preserve state funds as long as possible? So when the federal funds are over, we have state funds available to pick up the pieces when we so desperately need it 8 to 12 months from now. So the key is to leverage the federal funds, which Alaska's very, very good at doing, to the degree possible. I do have Mr. Dan Wayne with Legislative Legal online. And Mr. Wayne, if you're equipped to talk about loans and all things pertaining to loan payments and delayed loan payments and things of that nature. So, Mr. Wayne.
Good morning, Madam Chairman. Is there a specific question?
I think to what degree can the state direct a bank or a financial institution to behave a certain way? And I see that we also have Mr. Bill Milks on the line too. Perhaps he can answer that. But this is the question, is to what degree does the legislature have authority to direct a financial institution to behave a certain way?
Madam Chairman, I think Bill Milks is probably better equipped to answer that question. I can respond to it, but I think he might know more than I do about this.
Okay, so Mr. Milks is on the line. Mr. Milks, did you hear the question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. So I think as was mentioned earlier, the other body's working on a bill similar, but as I've looked quickly at SB 242 and sections 5 and 6, 4, 5, and 6. It looks like what's being proposed is a moratorium on evictions, moratorium on foreclosures. And the Madam Chair, your question is a very good one. I mean, that essentially would be, I think in our view, some government action that's been taken that can, for the public benefit, that can have an economic consequence on a private entity, whether it's a bank or a private landlord. So right now there is under the Alaska Disaster Act statutory provision that addresses compensation when the state determines it's necessary to commandeer property in response to a disaster. That's at AS 2623-160. So I think as the committee reviews, works on this bill, a couple issues might be whether or not to more finely tailor sections 6 and 7, I guess, to address the specific kind of damage that could occur to a landlord, lost rent, or to a mortgage holder. I guess that's, we do think the existing Disaster Act addresses the subject generally, but not precisely on the issues of raised in the bill as far as the non-payment of rent and mortgage foreclosure. So I guess our view would be if the bill just passed as is, probably AS 2623-160 would kick in any event when there's government action that is taken for the public benefit, then I think the some kind of method of compensation to the private party has to result.
Okay, so Mr. Milks, I'm not sure if I fully follow, but if a bank and a landlord, for example, are working together, or even a bank and a borrower for a vehicle are working together, and the landlord or the borrower cannot make either one of those payments, can the statute that you referenced, what does that mean in terms of the bank? Do they simply not get paid their mortgage payment? And what is the bank's recourse?
Yes, and I think, you know, as I, you know, obviously, like all of us, we're working very quickly, but as I read through section 6 and 7, it says a moratorium on eviction for non-payment of rent. Well, if the state government goes in and says to a private landlord, you cannot evict, and that private landlord then follows that state law, there's, I think, what we would call a taking of property by the government, and here it would be essentially the ability to exercise their legal recourse to evict a person. The economic consequence, I think, would be lost rent receipts by the landlord, and that's a government action, so there would be some likely what we consider under the law a taking of property by the government. Our existing disaster statute does address compensation when the government takes an action that affects the private property. When it takes that action pursuant to its disaster relief powers, that statute provides a method for compensation. Again, the bill, just like maybe the bill in the other body that's more specifically focused on moratoriums on foreclosures or evictions, could be drafted to specify the kind of damages that we're talking about that a bank or a landlord could receive from the government.
Okay, so I think what we're looking at here is maybe the banks are somewhat to be made whole by this government subsidies or government economic plan. We have questions from Senator Willikowski, followed by Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of unusual that we get legal advice from the Department of Law as opposed to our own attorneys, although I know Mr. Milks is an excellent attorney. Are you saying the governor shut down barbers, restaurants, tattoo parlors, all kinds of other small businesses? Are you saying that all of those small businesses are entitled to compensation from the state because of that action?
No, I'm not. All I'm addressing right now is Section 6 and 7 of this proposed bill. That's the limit of my comments. We're trying to react quickly to questions about SB 242.
Senator Willikowski, follow up.
Just having a hard time seeing what the difference is. If this is much more limited than the actions that the governor took, which with the stroke of a pen shut down and laid off tens of thousands of employees, took away their jobs. So, I mean, it's the same logic. If your logic prevails, then every single Alaskan arguably is entitled, that has their job taken away. The small businesses have had their revenue taken away. I would be very careful about the statements that you're making now to this committee.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, appreciate your comments. I think we're just trying to aid the committee right now. We will continue to fine-tune these legal issues. The rough statutory reference I made was concerning commandeering or destroying property under AS
2623-160. Yeah, so I think the question essentially is, and I see that Senator Wilson has a question as well. Senator Wilson, we can ask Mr. Milks a question, or we can change the question a little bit more nuanced, as in, what can the state do to help businesses like the one Senator Willikowski mentioned, as well as expanding it to banks and so forth. So, Senator Wilson, what is...
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess to first follow up on Senator Wilkowski's question then, you know, if we have closure of businesses and licenses or professional licenses are thus private property to those licensee, to those licensees, it would similar have the same effect. But that's a conversation for later. I guess my question is that everything is sort of in speculation. There is no defined statute, and then thus we would have to basically be let the judicial branch of government sort of set policy and standards to what our actions would happen today. Is that my, that's my understanding of what I'm hearing, is that we can put these things into statute, but really it's going to be a judicial case that really validates whether we can or cannot take these actions. I guess that's my question. Is,
well, you know.
Sorry, Madam Chair. What was there a question?
Yeah, if I can, Madam Chair. Let me rephrase my question then. So, just to summarize, we can do take these actions for utility, for evictions, and whether or not the state will be held liable to make these other businesses whole will be then just a litigation case, and the court system would then decide whether the legislature does indeed have these powers or not.
Yeah, this is Bill Meltz again. As far as 6 and 7, we're addressing possible approaches that the legislature could take in that 6 and 7 to address this moratorium. So I think Mr. Goering is on the line, and one that I think could make a comment for you about the regulated utility environment and the implications of Section 5.
Thank you, Mr. Milks. I think what we want to do is we have about a half an hour. This is an unresolved issue. I think it's pretty murky about what the state's ability and role to direct businesses, but as Senator Wilkowski pointed out, the governor has and various mayors have shut down businesses, and the federal government is responding by having a significant bailout. Now, what we can do is if there's $1 billion coming to Alaska, because we qualify as one of the small states, does it make sense for this committee to at least put some type of intent language saying that by holding harmless for a period of time for renters, mortgagees, and borrowers, that some of this $1 billion be spent on making banks whole, air transportation whole, things of that nature. Now, that's something that we can consider for intent language. But I think one of the other issues is we also might want to ask, is there a way, because we brought this up before, if people, if employees are receiving unemployment insurance benefits and potential Fed money of $600 a week, to what degree can landlords find out about that so they know that their renter is receiving money and does have the capability of paying? And to what degree can the state provide parameters that employees, if they have the means, if renters have the means to pay, that they should pay? So I don't know if Mr. Goering, well, we have Department of Law, or is it, we can ask Dan Wayne, our ledge legal. Mr. Wayne.
The question was, to what extent can we, I'm sorry, can you please repeat the question? I'm drafting amendments and listening at the same time. It's difficult.
Thank you for multitasking. If a employee receives compensation, either through his employer, who's been made whole with a federal loan, small business loan, and continues to pay employees, or the employee receives unemployment benefits plus the federal subsidy, how can a landlord find out and know who's, which one of his renters are being made whole? And number two, how can we direct renters to continue to pay rent if they have the means to do so?
Well, the first question is, I think that that would probably be private information that the tenant or the employee would have to give up voluntarily, give the employer permission to provide to the person that's asking. The second question is, I had it on the tip of my tongue. What was the second part again?
It's in essence, and if they are, essentially you answered it. It's not that, can we force someone or provide intent language that it is the intent of renters to prioritize rent?
I don't think so, and I think that this kind of has a little bit to do with how I would have answered the previous question, which was to point out that there's a constitutional provision that prohibits the state from adopting a law that impairs the obligation of contracts, which a lease is a contract, and also prohibits the Article 1, Section 15, I think, or 18 is the one I think that Mr. Milks was referring to. Private property shall not be taken or damaged for public use without compensation. So like any constitutional provisions, when a court looks at it, in a case where a law is challenged on the basis of one of those, a court would probably apply a balancing test. And in this case, they would probably say that the rights of the people involved to be free from the consequences of an impairment of contract or a taking are offset somewhat by the need for the government to address public health, safety, and welfare. And I think that they would also look at the how narrowly tailored the law is, was it merely sufficient to deal with the crisis, or did it go beyond that in some way? And if it's something that they felt was overly broad, they might say, you know, it was a little too broad for us to justify it through this balancing test.
Okay, thank you. I know that Senator Wilson had a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just looking at not just the sticks that we can use, but what are other incentives and carrots that we could use in trying to help folks out in this time of need. We don't want to have businesses be penalized, but at the same time, we want them to be sort of held harmless. Just didn't know if we could offer some type of, I don't want to use the word tax credits, but just ways that we can help incentivize some of these losses if they could prove, you know, if they were able to sort of help some of the debt management, or if they give incentives to other businesses or loans or ways that maybe that they don't charge interest rates and we can write the interest rates off as part of a tax credit to them. Just trying to help the hopefully committee. I know that we don't have the time to look at all those efforts now with our limited time we have here left in this wonderful town, but just to know if we can look at ways that we can incentivize the banks, utilities, and other folks, and not just to take the negative action, but just ways that we can help them encourage to let the negative
yes.
action.
Thank you.
Another point I'd like to put on the record is that as far as telling banks what to do, this is Dan Wayne, by the way, from Ledge Legal, for the record. There is a federal preemption issue. National banks and federally chartered savings associations are covered by federal law, and if there would be a conflict between our law and the federal law would prevail.
Thank you for that. I see Senator Olson had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just more of a comment, since time is of the essence, and I feel like we're, as you put it, we are trying to get the perfect is getting in the way of preventing the good to prevail, and the micromanaging and the getting down, and as you put it, getting down in the granular is slowing us down, and because of that, I'm afraid we're going to be falling behind if we don't do something rather quickly.
Senator Olson,
I appreciate your expeditious.
Thank you. I think what we may do is we will set this bill aside. We're not passing it out today, or at least now. I would like this committee to continue thinking about this bill and working with Julie Lucky about any intent language, any amendments, things of that nature. We do have floor at 11. I think it behooves us to perhaps meet here again this afternoon at 1 o'clock to continue working on this bill. What I do ask is if you have amendments, please work them through Julie. She can get them drafted quickly. We can even work with some conceptual amendments as well. We don't have to have them be perfect. So, and we also just have to realize that we cannot cover every contingency. There will be things that will happen that we just can't address. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with that, and I think we all do here at the table. As things progress, we've got a long way to go as this bill, you know, that hasn't even passed Congress yet. Hopefully tomorrow it does. But your points are right on, and hopefully that things will settle down. We can come back and pass the capital budget and then pick up any things that we've missed once we see the federal law in front of us and can read the fine print. So thank you.
Thank you. To me, the topics are that we can direct to Senator Stedman as he looks at the appropriation is food, fuel, travel, and to me, we have potentially $1 billion that's coming into the state. Do we want to provide any kind of intent language to hold, to direct it in certain industries, tourism, fishing, banker, hold harmless to businesses, lenders, borrowers? So those are the kind of the big things that I think that we can potentially do. So is there any other questions or comments at this time? Okay, if not, we're going to just recess this meeting with the intent of trying to picking it back up approximately the 1 o'clock hour. So with that, this meeting is in recess.